Welcome to Challenging Colonialism, a podcast dedicated to amplifying the voices of Indigenous California. An important note from the start, the producers are two white male educator academics, and these are not our stories. This podcast will center Native voices, and our intention is to highlight the significant work being done by Indigenous communities to challenge ongoing colonialism, and to broadcast information about the resistance and resilience of Indigenous California in the past, the present, and the future. Today you'll listen to an interview with ally and agent of change Kent Lightfoot, discussing his work shifting the way archaeology is taught, practiced, and even conceived. Kent's impact has shown up in multiple episodes of Challenging Colonialism. I'll leave it to Martin to introduce him, but from our first episode on Mission Bells, Lightfoot's influence has been present in our podcast.
I'm so grateful for you taking the time, and it's really, really great to be able to talk with you. And I think just to give you a little bit of background on what inspired me to reach out and ask about this is, you know, I was working with Gabe and Alec and some of the Awamutsa folks about their field school that they were doing. And I have to admit, I feel a little spoiled. The archaeologists that I work with are all people who are very committed to doing collaborative work and working with tribes in these really positive ways. But Gabe kind of, I think, helped me open my eyes to the fact of how most of the people I'm working with are basically from the Kent Lightfoot School. And the outside of that, there are, you know, most of archaeology continues to be non-collaborative. And I think I get a little bit in my head of like thinking, oh, everyone's doing this. And it kind of got me going down a rabbit hole and thinking about the field in general. And obviously, you know, we don't need to belabor the long history of archaeology, right, as this extractive practice. But it just made me think and wonder really kind of what was your path like, and how did you get to, you know, find a pathway that involved collaboration? And that's what kind of was the impetus for me reaching out to ask you. So maybe I could start by asking you just a little bit about your background. If you could tell us a little bit about kind of, you know, even before archaeology, and just kind of what got you into the field that you went into, and just a little bit about yourself.
Well, sure. No, I appreciate it. And Gabe, he's very generous, but there's a lot of other great archaeologists who are involved doing collaborative work today. Let me just say that. So I grew up here in Northern California, born in San Francisco, and then I grew up in Santa Rosa, 60 miles north. And I've always had an interest in history, archaeology, an interest in indigenous, you know, people of the area, and had always had an interest in maybe going into archaeology. So it was something that I'd always had a keen interest in maybe following. I got involved early on a little bit in the archaeology with my father, who was an ophthalmologist in Santa Rosa, and he used to do house calls back in the day. So this is old style, you know, medicine. And he had John McKenzie was one of his patients, who was the ranger at Fort Ross State Historic Park. And I went out there, and McKenzie was just a ball of fire, great guy, a real true historian, and really somebody interested. And he'd been doing, you know, a little bit of archaeology there, and certainly the history of Fort Ross, and he showed me around and got me really excited and everything. And so, you know, it's just something I've always been interested in. So I decided to pursue that when I went to school, and basically that's where that's led to me where I am today.
Okay, yeah, and you know, I think one of the things that I just mentioned before we start recording, that I was reading over some of these News from Native California articles that you wrote 2004, 2005, a lot of really interesting stuff that you wrote about back then. But one of the things you talked about is you talked about when you entered the field of archaeology in the 70s, you were surprised and disturbed by the underlying hostility that existed then between the Archies, as you put it, and the Indians. I wonder if you could give, you know, share a little bit about that. What did you find when you got into it?
Well, it was interesting. So I from Santa Rosa there, pursued going into archaeology. I went to Stanford and majored in anthropology there, and then I went to Arizona State University in their Department of Anthropology, a really great program, and doing Southwestern archaeology. But I was surprised that there was not a real close collaboration, working with various tribes. And I think that there had been issues, tensions, between native peoples and archaeologists that had went back some time. It was interesting, though, at ASU, I had some senior professors, Rinald J. Ruppe and Ed Dittert, who they were archaeologists who came out, they served in World War II and actually did archaeology a little bit before World War II. And then after World War II, they went on the GI Bill and they went through and they got their PhDs. But and they did work in the Southwest, specifically with the Ocama at Dittert. And so there was this a close relationship there. And they were doing a kind of archaeology that we know of as kind of culture history, where you work, with the local tribes. When I came into graduate school in the 1970s, archaeology had shifted to what they call new or processual archaeology, where essentially you were looking for generalized laws of human behavior. And the real specific individual history was not all that important. And there was not an emphasis in terms of working with local tribes. And I was actually somewhat surprised about that. And I worked in the Southwest when, where there are just some really, powerful, important tribes, here in the United States. And we weren't really doing archaeological work with them. And I found that surprising. And I myself, at that time didn't enter into any kind of real dialogue with them, but I was certainly surprised. And then from there, I went out to the East Coast and, a number of these processual or new archaeologists, there really wasn't much work going on with tribal people. There wasn't much collaborative work. And like I say, there was some early, like in the earlier years of archaeology, and certainly with ethnographers and others. But at least when that 70s period, 80s, there really wasn't too much going on. And I went to Northern Illinois University for a little teaching out there. And then I was at the State University in New York at Stony Brook. And it was there when Cal was looking for an archaeologist to essentially run their California archaeology program. And that was in 1987. And I applied and I was really honored to get that position. And I came out to Cal and I began to get involved in the archaeology here in California. And again, there wasn't all that much collaborative work, but there was one of the archaeologists at Sonoma State University who I had known back in the day when I was living in Santa Rosa, and actually had done a little bit of archaeology work with him. He was really at the forefront of really developing collaborative relationships. And he and then Breck Parkman, who was a state park archaeologist, were two who were really involved in this. And this was in the 80s. And I got involved, talking to them. I got to know both of them. And because of my earlier experience with Fort Ross State Historic Park and John McKenzie, I needed to start an archaeological project there in California. And I talked to Fredrickson and I talked to Parkman, and they said, "Hey, why don't you try to work with the, at Fort Ross State Historic Park?" And that started a project where I began to work there, and both Fredrickson and Parkman had good relations with the Kashaya Pomo, and they introduced me to the Kashaya. And it was from there that I began to be schooled in what, collaborative archaeology really is, and how we might do it, and how the field could really benefit from it. So it was really, coming back out to California, working with Fredrickson, working with Parkman, and then being introduced and getting to know the Kashaya, and doing some work at Fort Ross State Historic Park. That's how I really got involved in doing collaborative work.
Martin, one thing I really want to emphasize in talking about our, the California Archaeology Program and all of the collaborative work we did is a real critical person was Roberta Jewett, my wife and my lifetime partner. She was really played a really important role in getting our California Archaeology Program in those early years and then throughout its development. And she also played a really important role in working with our tribal friends and colleagues. In many ways, I think was super important in terms of really developing connections. And I think, as you know, relationships are so important. And Roberta was really able to really forge some relationships that, of course, that we still have, So anyway, I just really want to emphasize that point in terms of talking about the program itself.
Yeah, at that time, the 70s, 80s, there wasn't a lot of collaborative work. And quite frankly, Berkeley didn't have a really very good relationship, with a lot of the California tribes because of our history. I mean, there have been a lot of, from an archaeological perspective, some really interesting work done. But there hadn't been really much collaborative work done. And there had been sites that have been excavated that many tribes felt, shouldn't have been, excavated. And then there were the whole issue of human remains and, all that. And I had no idea before I came to Cal what I was walking into. And, and that the Hearst Museum had a number of human remains and associated funerary objects and other materials. And so I was dealing with that as well. And I found when I would go out and talk to tribes, I was a kind of a white guy walking in there from Berkeley. There wasn't a warm greeting going on, because of the our legacy at Berkeley of, collecting human remains and associated funerary, but not working with the tribes on that, and they didn't really have much of a voice on that. And so that was also an issue, and I recognize that w to move forward, at least here at Cal, we needed to really develop a collaborative program. And thankfully, I came in with a series of other, and there were already some really great archaeologists at Cal at that time, but also Meg Conkey, Ruth Tring, and Pat Kirch, Jim Dietz. And they also recognized that as well, that we really needed to develop that. And so we stopped doing any kind of, because up at that point in time, they were still doing excavations of indigenous cemeteries without any kind of tribal input. So we stopped that. There was quite a, I won't go into that here. as a, and a, shall we say, an untenured assistant professor and dealing with some of our senior social cultural professors about issues of academic freedom and stuff like that. It was not exactly a pleasant time for me. But we put a stop to that and, basically began to make it. If you're going to, work on indigenous materials and you're working from Cal, you need to have, the backing, support, and really partnership of the tribe itself. And so we began to implement that. And so from that, our collaborative program, at least at Cal, began. And again, I appreciate Gabe saying, he's a great guy. But I want to emphasize that there were other programs that were doing, moving into this direction of the, I mean, collaborative archaeology. The 1990 NAGPRA, Native American Graves Repatriation Act, that had been passed. And, so there was a lot of concern about just relationships with tribes and everything. We were certainly one, doing, I think, some really good work. And I've been blessed to work with some really fantastic people at Cal, great graduate students, undergraduates, who have gone on and have gone far beyond, what I was trying to do. So.
You mentioned somebody I was going to ask you about. I mean, so much of really academic work, but probably any kind of work is about the mentors and the influencers that we have in our life, right? That kind of take us there. And you brought up a name that I've heard a lot. I never got to meet him, but Dave Fredrickson from Sonoma State. But I've heard when I worked with Mark Hilkema and other folks mention he seems to be the guy who, at least from my vantage point, gets mentioned the most in terms of really championing collaborative work, working with tribes. Could you tell us a little bit about Dave Fredrickson and who he was and kind of his work?
He was just he was a fabulous guy. Really genuine. And he was really in some ways, you'd say a little bit eclectic in a sense. He was a musician. He had a lot of different interests. He was a Cal graduate student under Heiser and didn't get along with Heiser. And again, there's others that could probably get into that story a little more. And he left, and I think he was driving a taxi and doing some other things. But he eventually did his work at UC Davis, and got his PhD there, and was hired at Sonoma State University, and to really get their anthropology program going. And he was just a real people person, really thoughtful, and just really, he did good archaeology, and he was very committed that it should be done, working with the stakeholders, the people that you're really, working with should be part of that. And so it was that commitment that he really brought to it. He set up a really fantastic graduate program at Sonoma State, in which he produced some really fine archaeologists. And there's a number of them, I think, that you're probably meeting, who were students of his. See, I was never a student of Fredrickson. I was a student of his in a sense, because he certainly was a mentor of mine, but I was not a formal student. But a number of our California archaeologists were students of Fredrickson and the really fine program that he established at Sonoma State, and has continued through time. So he was really, I think, a key person. If you're, writing a book or writing an article about, collaborative archaeology and working with tribes.
You mentioned another person in those articles, Breck Parkman, who you just mentioned too, from California State Parks. But you also mentioned somebody, Otis Parrish from the Kashaya Pomo. Could you tell us a little bit about well, both Parkman and Parrish?
Well, Parkman was, the state park archaeologist, and he had worked with Lowell Bean. And Lowell Bean, again, was, one of our really, great anthropologists here in California. And of course, Lowell Bean was really an ethnographer, but one who was really committed to working with tribes. So Lowell Bean, and he was at Hayward, at that at time, CSU, it was known as CSU Hayward back then. He was somebody who, again, had a number of people that he mentored, and Breck was one of those who went through the program with Lowell Bean. And so he also had this, I think, really strong perspective about working with tribes and bringing that to California state parks. And Breck had a very large area that he oversaw, pretty much from San Francisco Bay, got all the way up to, I think, Eureka and that, and kind of that whole coastal area. He handled the archaeology there, and Breck, was very close to Fredrickson, and really, I think, a powerful voice in terms of bringing, the tribes into doing archaeological work. And he has, I think, a real pioneer, in doing, resource agency state park archaeology. He was one who really thought that, they should be, part of the project, if state parks is doing something. So again, between he and Fredrickson, it was just fabulous. They were the ones that introduced me to Otis Parrish. And Otis, today, he's one of the elders of the Kashaya Pomo, and he was a son of Essie Parrish, who was, one of the last of their real Well, I mean, there are a number of spiritual leaders today in the Kashaya, but she was one of the really renowned spiritual leaders of the Kashaya Pomo, and really served, I think, in many ways as their spiritual leader through some really tough times, back in the World War II and the 50s and beyond. And so Otis really knows, Kashaya history, and he knows the spiritual side, and so he's somebody who's really vested, and he the language. But Otis also has an interest in anthropology and archaeology, and he recognized that it didn't always have to be, bad. That you can do archaeology, but you can do it in such a way that it can actually be helpful, beneficial to tribes. And he was one who recognized that. And I was fortunate enough to meet him. And he actually came into our graduate program and got a master's there at Cal. And so I was able to work with him closely. And he really, in many ways, was, of course, mentoring me. And he was a key person too, in terms of just, my perspective on collaborative archaeology. And, he introduced me to his sisters, Violet and Vivian, who were just real in terms of understanding Kashaya people and their history and the tribe and everything, were just really great in terms of being able to talk to them about that. And so it was through Fredrickson and Parkman, and then kind of getting to know Otis. And then from there, I was able to get to know some of the other Kashaya people. And yeah, it's all based on personal relationships. And so, yeah, it was, really fortunate for me. I was just, like I said, really blessed to meet all these really great people at a time when I was trying to get, a program going. And trying to figure out what, how to move forward here, at Cal to make archaeology so that it was something that would actually be beneficial to tribes. And they were all key people in that.
Yeah, great. I mean, it's amazing to me when you talk about, you mentioned earlier a little bit of how when you were first starting, there was a lot of pushback, right? Trying to ethically approach like cemeteries, for example, right? And it speaks to kind of the now something like this is kind of taken as a given, right? Like I feel like, there's a sense out there more readily of like, of course, this is the ethical way to do things. We should be working with tribes. But it's amazing how that can happen. And in 2005, when you wrote about this, you referred to collaboration with tribes as a quote, quiet revolution within archaeology. And I wonder now, 20 years later, thinking back on that comment, do you have thoughts on the change? Is it still a quiet revolution? Has it changed, or how do you see the progression of collaborative archaeology in the last 20 years?
Well, I think it's, I mean, it's changed dramatically. I think we've gone through a major watershed in North American archaeology, California archaeology, where I think it's now recognized that, ethically, you shouldn't really be doing work on, ancestral places, indigenous sites, unless you're working with tribes. And I think that there's still some, differing opinions on that. But I think overall, especially with the younger generation of archaeologists coming in, I think they recognize that, and they recognize that developing those relationships are really important. The other thing is we're now being able to train, native peoples, in the field of archaeology, who can bring both a tribal perspective and then an archaeological perspective. And I was really fortunate. I was able to work with Sim Schneider and Peter Nelson, from the Federated Indians of the Great Rancheria, who came into our program. And again, I learned much from both of them. And they were PhD students, of ours at Berkeley. So I think it really has, changed. Fundamentally, the field has. And I think if you go to any of our national or meetings, our Society for California Archaeology meetings, and you look at the papers and you look at what they're talking about, there's a lot of it is kind of collaborative work, or they're have partnered up with a tribe and they're talking about and doing that work. And I think there's some really exceptional work going on now. That's not to say that we can't do it, can't do it better. And that we still have, issues with tribes. There's no question about that. I mean, at least, an old white guy like me, when I walk into a room and say, "Hey, I'm from Berkeley," let's just, anyway, but it has changed. It has changed. It's really transformed, And like I say, I think it really is a watershed in terms of just how the field, is practices now. And the thing that does drive me crazy sometimes is I get people talking to me about archaeology as if we're still back in the 1950s, at Cal, with Bob Heiser and others, and it's we've changed, fundamentally from those days. But there's still that, and I think that'll always be, I think, part of the legacy of Berkeley.
Sure. Yeah. Well, one of the other the projects that I'm most aware of is the project you worked on with the Amamutsen down at Carrasco Valley. By my reckoning, maybe I'm wrong on this, it's maybe got started in like 2006 or 7 or somewhere around there.
That is correct.
Yeah, could you share a little bit about that project and how that came to be?
Well, again, it's relationships. I mean, I really do think a lot of, at least I think in the field of archaeology, how important that is. So and again, how blessed I've been to work with some of the really fine, graduate, undergraduate students and faculty and staff here at Cal. At that time, we had a grad student, Rob Cuthrell, who was in and who was just a remarkable student archaeologist. And he was interested in ethnobotanical and becoming interested in the whole issue of indigenous stewardship. And he had connected with Chuck Striplin, who was a in environmental science policy and management at Cal. And Chuck was very, again, very interested in indigenous stewardship. And Chuck was a member of the Amamutsen tribal band. And the two of them began talking to each other and to talk about maybe they could do, could do their dissertations, in a joint way down, in the Santa Cruz, that broader Santa Cruz area. And they had talked to the tribal chair of the Amamutsen, who was Valentin Lopez, the chair of their of the Amamutsen. And so then they got me involved because, I would kind of, be kind of helping them out and, their dissertation projects, and also kind of taking the lead on it through the university. And we met with Val, and I still remember we talked to him about doing some archaeology, in their ancestral lands. And he said, "What the hell would we want a bunch of archaeologists working on our, and so we talked to him though about the idea of doing collaborative archaeology. We'd been working with this a little bit in some other areas, Kashai and others, and kind of thinking about how to develop this and using some low impact methods and bringing the geophysical and some other methods to bear, where you're not really opening up areas until you really know what's there, and you really get a good sense of that, and you can really think it through the process and kind of a multi-stage approach." And so we chatted with him about that, and Val was very, very intellectual and very thoughtful, and he said, "All right, you guys, I'll, you know, you you know, if we'll try it, But I'll tell you, if something, if something goes wrong, man, I said, okay, So we began to work with them, but it was, we had needed to really show that we could have a program that could think of and work with the tribal concerns, the tribal research questions, what the tribe want, and to do something that would actually benefit them. And at that time, the whole issue of indigenous stewardship, really taking care of the land and really looking at the issue of how do you come in and nurture various kinds of plants and animals that are so important in terms of their economy and their spiritual basis. And there was a lot I think archaeology can do with that, because we can actually recover the various of these plants and animals in an archaeological context. And so we were able to work with him, and then also other members of the tribal band who were able to put together this very low impact. And we began to working at Caroste Valley, in the Santa Cruz district there at State Parks. We were able to put together a program, and Rob did his dissertation, and Chuck did his dissertation, and both did fantastic work. And kind of that was really the impetus of that program. And then since then, we've maintained that relationship, and have done some, I think, some really, really great work. And in the meantime, have brought in other graduate students and others who have been able to, I think, benefit from the idea of doing collaborative work, seeing it in action. And the other thing that I've really, really, really proud of is just all a number of Wamamutsun, especially some of their young stewards who have come in and have, I think, really gotten an interest and have learned about, some of the kinds of archaeological methods that can they can use that can really benefit understanding, their history and their relationships with the environment and other aspects. So yeah, so that project, yeah, that was a great one. But again, it wasn't like I went down there and said, oh, hey, we should do this. It was one of these things that was kind of developed through, Chuck and Rob and others. And then, working with Val. And then the other thing is Mark Hilkema, who is the state park archaeologist there. And he's fabulous, and was really, again, somebody really committed to collaborative archaeology and working with tribes. And we had his full backing, and he became really, a partner in this. So we had state parks involved. And we had the tribe involved, and we had UC Berkeley, and then we brought in people from UC Santa Cruz, Diane Gifford Gonzalez and others, who were also key players. And there are a number of archaeologists, and then also other different, we had a number of different specialists who became part of this broader project, to really understand the environment and fire regimes, and it really took off.
It seems to me that now the Amamutsin have their whole land stewardship program, right, where they train some of the tribal youth to be doing like actual stewardship, including like controlled burns. But it seems to me that that really came out of that collaborative project that was there in Caroste. Is that your sense too, that the
Well, I don't know if it exactly came out. I mean, Val, and others in the tribe might have already thought about, setting up a land trust, but we certainly helped stimulate that, I would say, and certainly would help push that. And I was, again, fortunate to be, when they established the land trust, I was on their board, and I served on their board for a number of years. And so I really saw it from the beginning and saw it develop, and I do think the collaborative work helped. And I think the whole idea of, having the tribe work with partnerships with resource agencies like state parks, and then with academics, at UC Santa Cruz and UC Berkeley and elsewhere, I think that really also, kind of stimulated that the land trust could be something that could really bring in all these different people and as needed could provide expertise depending upon what the tribe needed. And I think that that certainly that project, the project we were on, I think certainly facilitated that. Yeah.
The tribal interests seems like such a key part of that, right? And you talked about that before of how, how can the field of archaeology, how can people working in that do things in collaboration so that the questions that are asked are of service to tribal interests? And thinking about Kitoroste Valley in particular, the example that comes to my mind, and maybe there's others, but is the work that was done around is it the California hazelnut? Am I thinking the right thing there? I wonder if you could speak a little to that, because I think that's such a great example of how the questions that are being asked can be of service to tribes.
Well, you know, it's one of those things that today, when you look at the environment, of coastal California, really many areas of California, it's changed dramatically, in the last century or two. With the whole, a lot of the different colonial ventures, the logging, which you know very well about and talked about, and then also, of course, the fire suppression, and how that, it's changed a lot. And so what you see out there is not what used to be there. And one of the things that I find really fascinating is that in doing this work in Kitoroste Valley and Rob Cutthroat and others being really intimately involved in that, is that we were doing archaeobotanical work where we were recovering plant remains, in archaeological context that could be very well dated through radiocarbon dating. And it was interesting that while hazel is not, something that is really common out there now, we found lots of hazelnuts in the archaeological record. To a point where even, Rob felt that, they're probably managing hazelnuts out there, through fire and through other stewardship activities. And yet today, there isn't that much out there. And so when you look at the environment today and you look at what it was in the past, this collaborative work with the tribes and with the state parks, the resource agency, and the academic entity, can really, I think, unlock a lot of those secrets in a sense of just what did that environment look like. And I think what's really important is you can then use that as a baseline. Maybe we would want to maybe incorporate maybe some of these indigenous stewardship practices today in order to bring back some components of that. I mean, we recognize the modern world's different, and it's never going to be exactly the way it was, pre-colonial. But there's a sense, I think, in which, well, maybe we should bring some of these kinds of plants and animals that have a real economic and spiritual and, just importance to a lot of the tribes, to bring them back. And, a lot of the indigenous stewardship practices were really, using cultural burning in a really, I think, strategic way to open up the environment and to basically facilitate the diversity and the availability of a lot of these important plants and animals. And I think that that's something that, we really should be doing today, especially given the, it limit, brings down the risk of major wildfire. There's all sorts of reasons why, which we don't need to get into here. But I think that, I think that that hazelnut, that was part of that. And it was just a discovery, that was made that in some ways, just kind of was, I think, rather profound that, hey man, things are really different, and a lot of it had to do, really with the indigenous stewardship that was going on.
Yeah, to me that last point is such a important one, given the colonial frameworks and the ways that people have historically dismissed California Indian communities. To be able to show like here are some real solid examples of just the extent to which they were managing and really creating the environment around here, right? This wasn't happening outside of people, it was being managed by people.
I think
Is such Yeah.
sometimes you it's not as common, but it was when I first came in the field. You deal with ecologists and others who would talk about, the Holocene, and they would talk about the environment, and they would, and there was no discussion about people whatsoever. And I was going, well, I'm not so sure that's the case, And I think there's now a recognition, and, if you're going to do ecological work, especially within the last 10,000 years, and you're in the state of California, you better have an understanding of just what the, ancestral indigenous people were doing, and what kinds of practices they were doing. And I think it almost turns to a point where they need to have like a collaborative work with tribes, and maybe with archaeologists and with others, if you're really going to do ecological work, and understand it in California. You can't do it separate from people. You just can't. And maybe you can go back beyond the Pleistocene or something and you can do it. But yeah, if you're doing ecology and you're doing trying to understand what the environment was all about in the state of California, I mean, you've got to have indigenous people involved, and you have to have an understanding of what they were doing.
Yeah, well said. But my next question for you is maybe a little bit of a broad one. So I wonder if, just reflecting on your work, you've recently retired, you've been doing your work for a long time, but is there, can you pinpoint maybe one or a couple things, or what are some of the things that you learned the most through working collaboratively that you've learned from tribal members, tribal communities?
Well, just the how you treat, I think, the archaeological record, that, it's more than just, artifacts and, human remains, et cetera. But, these are ancestral materials and ancestral people. And I think it's the issue of, just having respect, I think, is really, really important, I think. And that's something I now, understand. And when I was initially, trained and everything like that, I didn't really have that perspective, back in the 70s, but I've certainly gained it. The other thing is just what you can learn collaboratively, working with people, and not just with the indigenous people, which again, I've learned so much from them, but just other people in other different fields and other things, and just how important collaborative work is. You can't really do, I think, good science today, if I can use that word here, without really being collaborative. You can't do it as a silo. It's got to be integrated in. And if, for example, the work that we've done with the stewardship, tribal perspective, tribal work, working with the partners are really critical. But in addition to that, and along with the archaeologists, is you need people who understand the environment, the palynology, understanding just the fire regimes, the fire ecologists. The geology and bringing the geologist in as well, there's a whole series of different people. And so the idea that you can do practice something like archaeology, in some kind of silo, it's just not possible. It's got to be fully integrated into a broader perspective. Now, that also does not make it easy. I'm talking about collaborative work as if, oh, everything's great. You're dealing with people. People have different perspectives. And sometimes you bring a team together, there's different perspectives. And even working with tribes, I think, as you well know, there's different perspectives. And so it's not necessarily easy. All right. I guess that'd be the third thing I'd say. Doing collaborative work, not a piece of cake. It takes a lot of work. And again, a lot of it's relationships and relationship building and just and how things can change overnight with the politics and everything. So it can be really difficult. And I won't go into details, but we've had projects that have been closed down where we had partners, but then things shifted in terms of the tribal politics, and we were out the next day. And that's just something you just have to recognize in doing it. But if you're a young scholar, say, trying to get tenure, in academia, or you're doing your PhD student, that can be really, really difficult. If you put all this effort into, and you got the permission and everything, and you got everything, but all of a sudden things switch. There's changes in terms of the tribal structure. They have an election, and there's new people in there, and they're not as, shall we say, friendly, to doing archaeology. Yeah, it can change, and it can really affect things. And I think you always have to, as a young scholar, always have kind of backup places where maybe you're going to work with maybe other tribal people that would, benefit from what you're going to do and would welcome you. So you got to really have backup. So those are some of the things that, yeah, I have certainly learned through the years. So.
Those are great lessons, and kind of leads me to the next thing I want to ask you about. And I won't keep it too much longer, too. I really appreciate your time, but I had a question. Just thinking about mentorship, and in your time at Berkeley, I mean, you've worked with a lot of folks. I made a little list, so bear with me. And I know this is not complete, but just some of the folks: Antoinette Martinez and Lee Panitch and Seth Malios and Scott Byrum, Kathleen Hull, Rob Cuthrow, who you talked about, Sarah Gonzalez, Peter Mills, Sim Schneider, and Peter Nelson, you talked about, Barbara Voss, Stephen Silliman, Gabe Sanchez, Mike Grone, Alec Apodaca. Anyway, there's much more too. I know that's not full. And yeah, I just a couple questions about mentoring. And of course, I can't help but wonder, of all these students, do you have a favorite in there? I kid, of course. I don't want to put you on the spot there.
Yeah.
Uh,
Now,
but
let me just say this. I've been
sure.
blessed. All right. Well, I'm working with just some of the brightest people that I know. And you listed some of them. There's others. But yeah. And the other thing I'm going to, it's just how much I've
Please.
learned from them. All right. Yeah. I mean, you're talking to me as if I'm some kind of mentor or something like that. Man, I mean, I'll tell you, I learned so much because they were usually really on top of the literature, really on top of the field. And, I was stuck in faculty meetings sometimes going, oh my God, I'll be like, the time, I didn't have quite the time that they did. So, and I think you appreciate that because you've probably gone to a couple faculty meetings. So, anyway.
A handful, well, my question really, the real question for you is just, are there particular things that you really stress, or what are kind of the main things that you hope that your students that you can impart to your students? What are the main kind of goals as a mentor that you try to pass along onto them?
Well, I think the key thing is to do something that's beneficial. That if you're going to do something, try to do something that's really going to help, humankind and, the state of California, and work, if you're going to work on not everybody who I've worked with, some of them are historical archaeologists and have worked with other, peoples and other things like that. But, you definitely want to work with the people. But if you're going to do indigenous archaeology, yeah, then you definitely want to work with your tribal partners and really understand what their interests are. But I think ultimately, I think you want to do something that's going to benefit the modern world. And that's why, some of the projects we've worked on, like with the stewardship, where, if you can really bring back some of the and be a facilitator of bringing back some of the cultural burning and really beginning to think about the environment today and how we need to really, in many ways, manage it and to really moderate it. Because, I mean, you look at these wildfires and everything like that and just try to deal with that. Well, I think that archaeology can really play a key role in that and making the point about what, the world was like, 500 years ago, maybe 1,000 years ago versus today, and what were the risk of wildfires, and what can we do about that in really a thoughtful, kind of a proactive way, through management. And so I think that, I don't look at archaeology as some kind of arcane discipline, where, you're kind of understanding people's past, and it's extremely important, everything like that, but somehow it's disconnected from the modern world. I think all people who have lived have, there's a perspective there that we can bring to bear today, especially the state of the world right now, which I think kind of learning from the past is really, really important. And so I think that was something, I don't know if I ever really voiced that very well, with the various, the great students who I've worked with. But certainly that's something I would really try to stimulate when they're thinking about what projects they're going to do and to do something that they could look back and be really, I think, proud of.
Yeah, I mean, those are great points, and yeah, we absolutely could really benefit today from learning from the mistakes of the past and progressing. The one last question I have for you, you write about this a lot. It wasn't something that was necessarily on my radar, being outside of your field, but you talked about the and it kind of fits under mentoring too, but the value of field schools, and you really seem to emphasize that in the writing and. I wonder if you could speak a little bit about what it is that you think is so essential to training archaeologists about the field schools, and tell us a little bit about what those are.
Archaeology is it's a multidisciplinary and it is collaborative, if you're going to really do it, I think today. And I think having field schools where you can really exemplify that is super important. And actually having a field school where you have tribal partners and you've got tribal people actually working with you, and where students are going to work side by side with tribal stewards or tribal partners, I think is super, super important. If you're going to understand archaeology in its context, and to talk about, the field schools, we talk about the broader research questions and what benefits it might bring to a tribe, and then just how then methodologically are we going to try to do that, and how do we come up with that process is all part of it. So, we talk about the research design, we'd have the tribal partner speak, and then, we try to implement it and show, the students. And sometimes, while we're out in the field, things just, we would have to modify or change, the particular trajectory we were working on. And I just think it's those kind of really where your hands-on kind of a case study like that is super, super important. And archaeology is not something that you can really learn via Zoom or, some kind of interactive, class or something like that. I mean, there's certainly aspects of it you can, but to really learn it, I think you really need to be immersed, in a field camp with people, living with them, for 4 or 5 weeks, working with your indigenous partners, but also having your research agency people like Hilkema and Breck Parkman and others out there with you, and all the state park people, because they also have concerns and they have issues they're dealing with as well, and you want to help them out. And so I think it's kind of bringing everybody out there. And then we would try to bring, if we had various other specialists, like palynologists or others, we try to bring them out and they talk about just, okay, how are we going to collect these, the materials that they need, and how is the proper way to do it. And so I just think, getting students involved in that, at an early time in their career, I think is really, really important. And getting them involved in a project where you've got research questions and you're trying to benefit not only, the indigenous people you're working with, but also, the resource agencies, state parks and others, National Park Service and others, and really seeing it, letting the students see that, and then just see how the methods are working, what's working, what's not working. We would talk about, well, we did this and it doesn't appear to work. So yeah, I mean, it was just a really great learning experience for me. And then oftentimes we'd get, our tribal partners out there, and they would have all sorts of, they would look at things and say, well, and there would be a lot of cross-fertilization going on out there. And I found that really powerful.
Yeah.
So.
No, it sounds like I'm looking at a quote here from one of these articles, and he said, "Nothing deflates morale and saps lively dialogue quicker than mediocre meals." And you're talking about hiring a couple of the Kashaya elders,
Oh,
Violet Parrish Chapel and Vivian Wilder, as chefs. So that was obviously a big part of it too, right?
Well, food is always important, and when you got great chefs like they were, and a lot of the indigenous cooks, typically we would try to hire, because they can provide some of the very best food. And also, as part of that, you bring them into the camp, and they, again, it facilitates conversation, and I think it really opens up doors that oftentimes will stay closed, if you don't have, right there in the camp where students can talk to various indigenous people, and if they're and the cooks, and then the other thing is you'd get oftentimes various foods, like huckleberry pie, and we got abalone done the Cassia way, and seaweed, and oh, it's just fabulous.
I've been able to witness the last couple of summers the field schools that Gabe Sanchez and Alec and Dalma Mutzen are involved with down in this area. And yeah, hearing you talk about that, I can absolutely see the influence and the value of that. And to see, when I was there, I was brought in to kind of talk about the history a little bit and to meet with them. And I know I was one of a series of different people who were brought in, and they were having and I could just see the value. And obviously interviewed a handful of folks for the other episode we just did about that. But I can see the value from the archaeological point of view, learning from the tribal members and vice versa. There's just, a lot of exchange going on there. So yeah, great
It's a
stuff.
it's really a synergy that develops, a really powerful synergy in terms of learning. And learning from others. And I've, if you look at me, I've really benefited from that, boy, being here at Cal, just learning from all these very, very smart people who are around here. Anyway,
My last question for you is just I know that you're officially retired, but I know that you're also still active and doing a lot of things. So what are you working on these days, and what are some of your projects?
Well, just working with like Scott Stevens and some others in terms of the whole issue of the who's our fire ecologist, maybe trying to put something out on the issue of just really showing that cultural burning was a really important part, of pre-colonial times, here in parts of coastal California. So kind of working on that and bringing in different lines of evidence, and then working with the Confederated Tribes of the Lejeune Nation with the West Berkeley site, and we had done some work, and we're talking about, right now and still in kind of the early formative stages, about maybe putting together something that about the West Berkeley site, which the Karina Gould and the Lejeune Nation, through God, thank God, we're able to have it. Basically, that land was rematriated back to them, so through some really generous people in the city of Berkeley, and now they are developing and will be developing a cultural educational center, that will basically be an Ohlone learning place of the past, present, and future, but also I think will be an educational place for people about just, the greater indigenous history and life ways of contemporary people in the greater Bay Area. So we're working on that, but it's still formative, still early. And anyway, so yeah, I got a few things going on.
That's great. Well, I'm glad that you're still doing that. That sounds like a really important project. And yeah, great. Well, hey, thank you so much for taking the time and sharing your insights and thoughts and everything and your stories. Yeah, really grateful to have you on here.
Oh, you bet. All right. No, it's always a great pleasure to see you, man. And I'll look forward to chit-chatting with you again.
Challenging Colonialism is produced by myself, Daniel Stoneblum, and Martin Rousseau Martinez. All interviews by Martin. All audio engineering and editing by Daniel. All music by G. Gonzalez. And logo art and animation is by Professor John Jotelianos. Follow us on Twitter, subscribe to the podcast, rate and review on whatever platform you use. Thanks for listening.